And this is Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria, and KTCB Killamook, 91.9 and 89.5 FM, respectively. And, of course, we are stroking madly on the World Wide Web stream. Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. A couple of minutes early, but I can probably fill it. My friend Larry Barrows died last week on Wednesday, October 8th, at age 66. The cause was primary afflictive aphasia, a rare disease that gradually diminishes speech until there are no words left to speak. Which is a sad irony because not only did he graduate from Oregon State University as an honor student in English, he once had a radio program here on KMUN that he called Words, Words, Words. Every Thursday night at 7 p.m., for 119 weeks, from 1986 to 1988, the KMUN audience heard Larry announce, "Hello, listeners, I'm Dyer Day, and the show is Words, Words, Words." Larry's program was during KMUN's early years, which, like most childhoods, were very exciting, wildly vibrant and spicy, and certainly experimental public radio. I think Words, Words, Words was among the very best KMUN has produced in it, as of tomorrow, October 17th, 31 and a half, exactly 6 months, 31 years and 6 months, tomorrow on the air. Larry Barrows spoke his last words as Dyer Day on Thursday, March 31st, 1988. This is what he said, and I reprinted it twice in my newspaper in 1988 and again in 2002. Dyer Day's Last Words by Larry Barrows. Lately, I have had a sense of things closing in and closing out. That is to say, the times, once again, are a-changing. Trouble is, I have lived just long enough to have accumulated experimental confirmation of the old saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I have a sense that the nation is waking out of a bad dream, only to discover the house is on fire. We're coming to the end of the Reagan presidency. Remember, this is 1988. And by the way, Larry, as Dyer Day, wrote this in verse. And some wistful, slouching movements in other directions are beginning to manifest. Nothing that a few covert monkey wrenches can't fix, though. And after all, Reagan never was the problem. He and his whole coalition are only a physical manifestation of the demons that have been eating us for years, centuries even, millennia for that matter. We've been backing into our future so long now, if we were to turn around and face it, I reckon we would just start walking back into the past. Maybe that's what the Reagan years were all about. Oh well, Jeremiah never stopped Jerusalem from getting itself destroyed. Be that as it may, I would like to make some observations. I have felt a deep compulsion, like the ancient mariner, to grab a hold of the wedding guest and say, "There was a ship." Now, the mariner only managed to stop one of three, but he did get his story out, and I reckon one of three to be a pretty good average. Poetry does not record why the other two didn't stop, but I can venture a fair guess. There was a party going on, after all. When the mariner said, "There was a ship," one of the guests probably said, "I doubt it," and the other probably said, "Yeah, but so what?" They both went on to the party. The third stayed to listen. Like I say, a pretty good average. There's a pretty good metaphor, too. But after all, it does come out of the 18th century and is somewhat dated. I have in mind another idea. It's as if I was walking through the killing fields with Dame Homo sapiens, and in her one basket, she is carrying all of her eggs and most of everybody else's. And I see with my mystical eyes this high-powered bullet on a trajectory due to intersect with her head. And I give a pull on her skirt, and I say, "There is a bullet." And she looks down and says to me, "Lousy sakes, hon, why you always dwelling on the negative? Look around. Look at all the directions from which no bullets are coming. Why can't you look on the bright side?" Well, I pause for a while and take that into serious account. After all, this is Dame Homo sapiens talking. But then I look again, and there certainly is a bullet traveling on said trajectory. And I look down into her basket, and I see that lots of those eggs are already cracked, and the yolks are dripping out the bottom. And I pull on her skirt, and I say, "There is a bullet, and your eggs are cracking, too." And she yanks her skirt away, and she says, "Go away, child, you bother me." And then I realize there is more at work here than simple common sense. And so I take a look at her head with my mystical eyes, and I see that her brain's already been more than two-thirds eaten away by demons, buzzing around inside her skull like little killer bees. And then I realize that when that bullet passes through her skull, there is better than an even chance that it won't do any damage to her brain at all. I find, however, that this insight gives me no comfort. So I think to myself, what shall I do now? And I remember what Martin Luther King said about if he knew the world was going to end tomorrow, he would still go ahead and plant a tree today. And I remember what Oliver Hazard Perry said, never give up the ship. And I remember what the famous poet said. So what if you can't beat 'em? Do you really, really want to join them? And that is why, over the life of my radio program, called Words, 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 I have paid increasing attention to the things that kill and degrade and endanger us all. I have visited our economic situation and pointed to the dangerous and increasing concentration of wealth, which in the past has often preceded economic collapse, and which usually goes hand in hand with the diminishing democracy. As of last year, the poorest 20% of our population received 4.6% of the national income, the lowest ever. I have taken a close look at the environment, considered the dangers coming at us, from the greenhouse gases we are pumping into the atmosphere, from acid rain, deforestation, desertification, from the massive amounts of toxins we are letting loose into the biosphere. I have mentioned the incredible rate at which species are becoming extinct, a rate of extinction matched only twice before in the history of life on this planet. Pointed out the connection of all these things to the unwise use of resources, unwise use of energy sources, particularly oil, coal, and nuclear power, unwise agricultural practices. As this pattern of unwisdom became clear 20 or 30 years ago, what also became clear is that it was all so unnecessary. It was not a natural and inevitable result of the ascendancy of our species on this planet. Stopping it all did not mean stopping our progress toward increased well-being for an increasing number of people. Not at all. There are other routes, much more benign, waiting only for us to choose them. But we haven't. My concern is that we have missed, or have by now all but missed, a window of opportunity. It is my perception that for every dilemma we have backed into, nature has reserved a solution for us, and that nature has also provided a leeway, a lag time, giving us every opportunity to resolve the dilemma so that we may endure and prosper. It is also my perception that nature will not suffer folly forever. For instance, nature has many ways to limit populations and to keep them healthy. Usually these mechanisms take the form of either birth control or death control. Some bird populations, for example, when they get too crowded, lay fewer eggs in the nest. It's no decision on their part, it just happens. A mechanism trips in. It is said that after World War II, or 1B, whichever, there was an above-average increase in the ratio of boy-to-girl babies born in favor of boys. Other populations use a predator-prey relationship. Sometimes vulnerabilities develop because of degraded habitat. Sometimes the vulnerability is in the nerves, stemming from too much close proximity. Sometimes in highly successful, top-of-the-heap predator populations, those with nothing bigger to bring them down. Sometimes something much smaller enters them. I think of the African leopard, particularly in an area of the, where was it, the Serengeti? No matter. What matters is that over a vast area there nowadays, any one leopard can take a skin graft from any other leopard without the slightest sign of rejection, something not normally seen in a population of mammals. Genetically, they are all virtually identical. What happened was that some time ago, a retrovirus swept the vast area clear of leopards, all but perhaps one mating pair. That brings us to retroviruses and the human population. Or for all we really know right now, we might substitute the word retroviruses. The term, the thing or things that make for the suppression of the immune system. But as I was saying, that brings us to retroviruses. And for now, we will stick to that term for it. In the wealthier countries of the world, population growth is slowing dramatically. In some, there is already negative growth, that is, reduction, in countries that were arriving at prosperity. And where the population growth was slowing, but which have now been sliding back into poverty, the population is beginning to grow more rapidly again. And in countries that have always been poverty-stricken, population growth has never stopped its dramatic increase. The suggestion is that for human populations in general, in these times, the arrival at a certain widespread level of well-being is a mechanism that limits population. Now I think of Africa, perhaps the most ravaged and disrupted, not to say raped, continent on the face of the earth. Throughout history, the wealth of Africa has been bled since early on to enrich other empires, other nations, other continents. Its civilizations have been repeatedly destroyed. The point is, had our ability, especially in the 20th century, to create wealth and well-being, had this ability taken the opportunities to do so in increasingly benign ways, and had that wealth been shared equitably among us, which, by the way, increases our ability benignly to create more wealth and well-being, the human population would have found a threshold, a holding capacity, at which the earth would have been able to sustain us well and indefinitely. But that didn't happen. We overran the mark because of our history of bad collective choices. And now, out of Africa, so we are told, I consider it yet unproven, but it does have a certain ironic value, out of Africa comes more than one retrovirus. Whether it is true or not, it certainly seems that nature is saying, time is up. When I was first listening to assessments of the AIDS phenomenon, it occurred to me, hearing the reports, so many cases in the U.S. 3 years ago, so many cases last year, so many cases this year, it occurred to me that the number of cases was roughly following a doubling pattern year to year. So in the way I have of worst-case situations, to see how bad they might get, so as not to be surprised, I calculated how long it would take everyone in the United States to get infected if the pattern kept up. I found that sometime in the year 1999, everyone would have it. Now, that did not devastate me, because I understood that such was not the nature of the disease. It did something to indicate the seriousness of the situation, though. That was some 4, perhaps 5 years ago. A few months ago, there was some renewed interest in the subject, and the number of carrier cases to date was mentioned. I went back and checked my calculations. The number of carrier cases to date exceeds the number indicated In those calculations, I fully expect the pattern will not continue. If it were to continue, the whole U.S. population would have it by 1995. We are assured this is unlikely, but I think there is a use for this type of thinking. It provides a perspective with which to gauge the known and the unknown. We don't know enough about this disease to be complacent or confident about it. There is renewed argument over the means by which it can or cannot be transmitted for one thing, for another. Viruses have extremely efficient methods by which they can transform themselves and thereby more effectively do what they do. They can be like keys which change themselves to conform to the lock on the next door, through which they must pass. Can or will this virus do that? Who knows? Lastly, even if the whole population being infected is extremely unlikely, as I believe it is, surely the whole population will be affected. Where will it stop? 3 million? 6 million? 12? 24? 48? Or 96 million? At what point does the difference between 24 or 48 or 96 and 250 million begin to lose the distinction in the absolute horror of the reality? This speculation on the unknown gives us a perspective on the known, for it helps us to realize the overwhelming negligence of the official and public response thus far. This overwhelming negligence seems to be deep-seated in the human psyche. It is as if the unreported injustices we have visited one another, one on one, group on group, since time began, have never gone away, but have accumulated and now manifest themselves in our nuclear arsenals, in the rapidly degrading environment, and in the plague that is upon us. Day by day we measure our overwhelming negligence on the composite yardstick of rampant militarism, government deficits, private and public corruption, heroin and economic consumption, religious shamanism, the parade of poverty and famine, apartheid, legless Central American children, the endless litany of our mea culpa woes. Perhaps the greatest woe of all is that the word of hope has already been spoken. Nothing new needs to be found to turn us from death toward life. Life abundant is inherent in the biosphere, or creation, if you will. Life abundant for all humans is inherent in the better side of our history up until now, especially in the better side of the history of the 20th century, in our increasing ability to provide for our own well-being. We, as humans, have only to choose it, one for all and all for one. And this we have not done. We have not. Perhaps we will not, but I refuse to believe that we cannot. And that was The Last Words of Dire Day by Larry Burroughs, who was Dire Day for almost 3 years. And as I said, he died last week. And I believe his program, Words, 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 was one of the best this station has produced in its 3 decades, plus 1.5. The day after Larry Burroughs died, I happily encountered a couple of old friends I had not seen in a while, who are very much alive. And I saw them at the historically infamous Shanghai bar known among Astorians as the Dirty D. They are Jim Oyola and his wife Marianne Duber Oyola from Cannon Beach, whom I have known separately and together for nearly 40 years. Our brief reunion, plus claims that this fall's salmon return seems to be record-breaking, prompted me to pull out of the archives of a defunct newspaper I used to publish, the North Coast Times Eagle, a few words Jim wrote back in July 1983. He holds a master's degree in oceanography from Oregon State University and has been a fisherman on the Columbia River and in Alaska. He also worked for Napton Towboat Company, which inspired this story. Salmon Passage by Jim Oyola. You remember the scene, the old Indian chief sitting in the teepee, and Dustin Hoffman crawls through the opening, "Grandfather," he yells. The wise old wrinkled man can hardly see or hear, but he knows. "Ah, grandson, the sight of you makes my heart soar like an eagle." So I was on this towboat at Lower Granite Dam on the Snake River. We were changing our routine a bit. No grain barges, no log rafts, no container or chip barges this trip. We were to cart 50,000 salmon smolt through the dams on a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers barge. I should have been home 3 days earlier, but dispatch, as usual, had kept us in a quandary. Always they change orders. The crew was bitching at each other. The oil needed changing in the main engines, and the weather report said the coast was having great weather, but at Lower Granite it was overcast and misting. The first person I met at Lower Granite Dam was Snake River John. He had 3 teeth on his lower gum, 1 atop. He had a 3-day beard on his 62-year-old face. In his earlier days, he probably stood 6 feet 6 inches, but age had slowly curled him over. He had an old mongrel dog as a sidekick, Trixie. They walked alike. John was in charge of the fish trapping station at night. It was his only job, and it lasted 12 weeks during the spring. The rest of the year, he and Trixie holed up in his trailer and recycled aluminum cans and tended his 6-acre farm, which he rarely left. He said he always wanted to have a family, but Trixie was it. As we watched the fingerlings singularly pass over from a small weir, he pointed out from which hatchery each was produced. They were his little lost cousins. Occasionally, an adult steelhead would be trapped in the weir on its return to the hatchery, and his dog would raise a hell of a fit. John said once she had jumped in after one, and he had to pull her out. His eyes sparkled when he talked about the fish, about the old days, when there were no dams, when he fished the river as a boy. But the swing shift was over, and lunch pail in hand, he and Trixie headed home. The other Corps employees were busy tagging fish. The operation was very complex and a little suspect. First, the fish were intoxicated in a mild alcohol solution. Then they were sorted out onto carrying tubes marked hatchery salmon, hatchery steelhead, wild salmon, and wild steelhead. A fin was snipped off for future identification. Their noses were poked into a tube where a piece of metal was clipped, permanently. This for electric surveillance of the fish. To further embarrass these mutants, they were branded with the letter F, which would grow on their sides like a 20th century reminder. All sorted, packaged, and displayed, the fish were pumped into our barge. We were to discharge them below Bonneville Dam. 20 hours later, on a beautiful, warm, clear day, we arrived at John Day Dam for a downstream lockage. The skipper had to call the office for further orders. I took a brief hiatus at the fish viewing station. It had been many years since I had watched salmon travel through a fish ladder conglomerate. Signs led me to a viewing area, but the public was only allowed to peek through a window at the fish ladders over the counting station. Had to be something better than this. I walked outside the area to find a door titled Authorized Personnel Only. Must be it. I walked down a winding metal stairway into a cozy little room with a plate glass window framing one side of the fish ladder. An old coffee pot was brewing on a small table. Numerous books and magazines were spread on a shelf. The fish counter had been an ocean troller who had retired in the area. I expected to see an old black cat sitting on his lap, but there was none. He liked to watch the fish, said he loved to catch them in his earlier days. He did not talk much, just smiled. About 5 minutes went by. All we saw were a couple of steelhead. One, in its beginning phase of the spawn cycle, looked worn, frazzled, discolored, and mutilated. It could barely kick against the current. Anticipation. Wait. After 5 or 6 minutes, the first salmon came into view, then a second right behind, both about 25 pounds each. I have seen a lot of salmon, Chinook, silver, humpy, sockeye, dog, all of them, but none with quite the stark beauty of these passing the counting station. They were not captured, packaged, or canned. They had a wild, purposeful look. Their journey had been 5 years of migration through dams, river, and ocean. They had experienced metamorphoses through fresh water to salt water, back to fresh water. They had made it, despite water quality depletion, hydroelectric dams, fishing efforts, high sea predators, and political mismanagement. God, what strong, silent, marvelous creatures. As they swam by with determined kicks, I found myself yelling with excitement. Neil Armstrong's first step on the moon. Portland winning the NBA title. The first dogwoods blooming in spring. They had made it. And my heart soared like an eagle. And that was Salmon Passage by Jim Oyelowo. And he wrote it for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, back in July 1983. And I reprinted it in, I'm looking now to remember exactly when I reprinted it. Pardon me, I do love the crinkle of newsprint. It's my other favorite sound, my other being the popping of a wine cork. It was the July, August, and September 1997 issue that I just read from, which is kind of yellowing and getting crinklier than ever. And in that same issue, I reprinted a story by Don Ryswick, if any of you remember him. He's dead now, too. He was the editor and the founder of the Columbia River Gillnetter. Remove the dams, he wrote. We all know what the main cause is, but the Power Planning Council doesn't want to act because of the tremendous political pressure put upon them. Dams are the problem, period. The Columbia River Alliance, which represents irrigators, bargers, and other river users, is fighting tooth and nail to keep anything from changing. The U.S. Supreme Court decision in March 97 allows industry groups to challenge the Endangered Species Act in court. The Columbia River Alliance has filed notice in federal court that it intends to sue the government to get a say in how dams are operated to save the salmon from extinction. The Alliance's 60-day notice names the National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Corps of Army Engineers, U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and Bonneville Power Administration as targets. The special interests of the aluminum companies, the power companies, and agriculture industries have driven the Columbia hydro system for decades. Their interest has been the prevailing interest over the interest of saving the salmon for far too long. Salmon restoration efforts have focused on hydroelectric dams, which have turned the Columbia and Snake Rivers into a series of lakes. These lakes, like a hot tub, heat up in the summer months to temperatures that the fish cannot survive. In my opinion, Bruce Loveland, executive director, is not interested in saving the salmon, but rather he is interested in stalling until there is no more salmon. Are no more salmon, pardon me. Let's cut the red tape and work on dam removal. That is the only solution, and it better be done fast, while there is still time left to act. And that was something by Don Ryswick, which was in the same issue of Salmon Passage by Jim Oyelowo in the summer or July, August issue of the North Coast Times-Eagle. And sort of as an epilogue to this program, yesterday, October 15th, was the birthday of Monique Trung, or Trung Kim An in Vietnamese. She and her brother David fought for the release of their father from the infamous prison of Khong Son Island, the so-called Devil's Island of Southeast Asia, where he had been jailed by the Saigon regime for daring to politically challenge the corrupt U.S.-installed government of Nguyen Van Thieu and Nguyen Cao Ky by campaigning for the presidency of South Vietnam in 1967 on a peace platform. A few years after the end of the Vietnam War and the fall of Saigon, David, who, like his sister Monique, attended university in the United States, was imprisoned in the U.S. on fabricated charges that he was a spy for the triumphant Hanoi government. He seems to have been an expedient scapegoat for this country's loss of the war. If there is even the slightest possibility that either Monique or David, if they are still alive and in the United States, if they hear this broadcast on any of the multitudinous media or are informed about it, I would very much like to hear from either or both of them again. And I guess that just about does it. I have a couple of minutes, so I shall read a poem by my friend Mike McCauley, who lives in Seaside. Dr. Zeus addresses the Modern Language Association. Surprised to be invited, he intends to explain how Bruegel has excited his eye, journey through the sky to a Hyatt house in some metropolis, kaleidoscope colossus, where architecture runs awry, reflecting glass, waterfalls among escalators, Dixieland jazz. He tries to realize this could be what satisfies their need. The creatures who used to read his stories, looked at his pictures. He wonders whether speech can reach their passions. Imagines an astronaut come to bear witness in a wilderness of alien thought. And that was Dr. Zeus Addresses the Modern Language Association by my old friend Mike McCauley. And you have to remember, I guess, that today is Duck and Cover Day. They're not calling it that, but that's exactly what it is for earthquake preparedness. It's going to be sometime after 10, and if you're, they don't want you to go outside because things could fall on you from buildings, so climb under a desk or a table. I'd like to relocate myself to maybe my favorite bar, the Dirty D Desdemona Club, and grab a glass of wine and just lay under the bar and wait until the whistle blows. I grew up in the duck and cover age as a kid, and then when I was in Vietnam, I was hitting the deck once or twice a day from all kinds of stuff incoming on us, even some of it friendly. And this has been Mike McCusker, Michael McCusker, Michael Paul McCusker, however you want to call me by. Some just call me Mac. Some people said I should run for mayor and they were going to write me in, but nobody has ever spelled my name correctly, so I would probably not appreciate the effort. And I might be here next week, next Thursday, just like Dire Day used to be here on Thursdays many years ago. If a few things don't happen to me to spoil my week, such as drones smattering me to ash on the sidewalk or my falling into a raging river. This is KMUN, Coast Community Radio, also KTCB, both Astoria, 91.9 FM, and Kilimook, 89.5 FM. Next up, NPR News. Headlines if I hit the right button.